The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
The 1st of October, 2010. I must tell you that things have progressed in a very strange way since I last spoke to you. I will talk to you about that in a few minutes. But in the meantime, I have to wonder how in the world anyone can claim that things are getting better. Sometimes the numbers are so clear they simply cannot be denied. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, median household income in the United States fell from $51,726 in 2008 to $50,221 in 2009. That was the second yearly decline in median household income in a row. In other words, America is getting poorer. Just let that statistic sink in for a little bit. In 2009, American families had roughly $1,500 less coming in than the year before. Not that the cost of living has gone down either. Have you been to the supermarket lately? Things are getting ridiculous out there. In fact, the middle-class American families are being squeezed as never before. More mothers and fathers are scrambling to find second and third jobs just to pay the mortgage and to keep the lights on and to put the food on the table. This is not a time of prosperity in America. The country is in a state of serious decline, and it is time to wake up and admit it. When you stop and analyze the new census data, something jumps out at you right away. You quickly realize that these income declines are not limited to just a few regions of the country. They are happening from coast to coast. Ladies and gentlemen, the U.S. economy is in deep trouble, and the proof is in the numbers. According to the Census Bureau, median household income dropped in 34 states in 2009, and the only state where median household income actually increased was in North Dakota. The Census Bureau data also revealed that of the 52 largest metro areas in America, only the city of San Antonio did not see a decline in median household income in 2009. 35% of all U.S. households now live on $35,000 or less. The number of Americans in the food stamp program increased a staggering 55% from December 2007 to June 2010. One out of every six Americans is now enrolled in at least one anti-poverty program run by the federal government. The only group that saw their household income increase in 2009 was those making $180,000 or more. According to the Huffington Post, the gap between the richest and poorest Americans grew in 2009 to its largest margin ever. The middle class is being systematically destroyed. At the rate we are going, we will eventually have a very small group of ultra-wealthy Americans and a gigantic mountain of very poor Americans that are barely able to survive. Jobs and factories are fleeing the United States so rapidly it's hard even to describe. The deindustrialization of America is happening right in front of our eyes, but the American people have become so dumbed down that most of them don't even seem to have the capacity to understand what is going on. I do think it's very important to understand, even if there's really nothing you can do about it. But things didn't have to be this way. America didn't have to merge its economy with communist China and allow them to keep their currency devalued 40% lower than it should be so that they could dump massive amounts of cheap goods on the U.S. Americans didn't have to elect politicians that believe that globalism is the answer to all their problems. The country didn't have to sign on to the WTO, NAFTA, and all the other free trade agreements that are destroying the American middle class. You know, I see it as all part of the death wish that I used to talk about on the discussion group series of talks I gave here on PRN on Sunday evenings. Americans know instinctively that it's all over, and therefore I believe that there is an instinct to accelerate this decline as quickly as possible, to sort of get it all over with. Labor is now a global commodity. American workers are now part of the global labor force. The bargaining power of the average American worker has dropped through the floor. Now the monolithic predator corporations that dominate your economy don't even have to deal with American workers if they don't want to. Meanwhile, the federal government, your state governments and local governments just keep going on into massive amounts of new debt in an effort to keep paying the bills. There are some state governments like Illinois that are basically flat broke. In fact, Illinois doesn't even bother to pay many of their bills anymore. Of course, the federal government is the worst offender of them all. The U.S. national debt is rapidly approaching $14 trillion, and most people have got so accustomed to it that we don't even talk about it much anymore. The truth is that the leaders of America should be in full-blown crisis mode in an attempt to fix this thing. The economy is collapsing off all around, and the country's leaders are pushing the debt accelerator to the floor as we head towards a giant cliff. These damnable politicians are prancing around the countryside telling us that everything's going to be just great as long as you cast your votes for them in the fall. And the mainstream American media keeps telling you that the recession is over and that soon the U.S. economy will be better than ever. Is it any wonder that faith in the mainstream media is now at an all-time low? According to a new poll just released by Gallup, the number of Americans that have little to no trust in the mass media, 57%, is at an all-time high. Hey, well, let's have the information. Let's get that over as quickly as possible. My name is Richard Martin, pronounced Richard Martin in French, if you happen to hear me talked about in Paris, France. If you wish to contact me and talk to the company here present on the toll-free number, you may do so, and the number is 888-874-4888. Yes, you may pick up the phone, and at no expense to your good selves, you may again call the number at 888-874-4888, at which point our trusted engineer will answer the phone and take your question, and I will be informed, and we will talk to you as quickly as possibly can, but it calls for you to call in, so please do so. If you'd rather send your information by email, that can be achieved by sending your emails to me at rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD, which stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once again, the email address is rm@gfawd.com. And finally, if you want to talk to me about your personal economic or financial situation and you would like to do so to me directly, you may call my direct line at any time. Just leave a message, your name, your phone number if I'm not at the other end of the phone, and I will, of course, call you back as quickly as possible. And you should call a number in Sarasota, Florida, which is 941-441-1682. And through the wonders of technology, it will come straight through to Singapore, and hopefully I will answer the phone. But you require to call, please, at the area code 941-441-1682. It's in the United States. And hopefully we shall touch base immediately thereafter. Well, ladies and gentlemen, a milestone was reached yesterday, the 30th of September, the date on which the Social Security Trust Fund officially began paying out more than it takes in. So let's see what we have here. 76 million baby boomers about to retire, life expectancies increasing, a Social Security Administration that's now paying out more than it's taking in, the Social Security Trust Fund holding nothing but $2.6 trillion in U.S. debt, that's to say U.S. Treasury bonds, a national debt over $13 trillion, the worst U.S. economy since the Great Depression, unemployment near generational highs, stagnant wages for over a decade, average personal savings rates of 6% of disposable income, minimal interest rates on those savings, home prices, which of course is most people's largest investment, down 20% from their peak, stock indexes, and most private retirement funds, down 25% from their peak, rising energy and healthcare costs. What a great backdrop to a wonderful retirement, huh? And while we're on the subject, let's take a gander at Medicare. There's only one little problem with Medicare and Medicaid. There isn't enough treasure in the universe to pay what's been promised to 45 million, soon to be 60 million, aging or aged citizens, each of whom can burn through $500,000 or more in the waning days of their lives. Medicaid covers another 60 million low-income citizens, and there are few limits on what can be billed to Medicaid. There are few limits on what Medicare spends on each recipient, most of whom contributed via Medicare taxes and monthly fees, perhaps 1 to 3% of the average outlays expended on them, which are in the neighborhood of $250,000 to $500,000 each. There's every incentive to build a system and virtually no incentive to limit medications, tests, surgery, etc. Then there's the culture of entitlement which permeates the U.S. Everyone deserves the finest care regardless of cost because it was promised to me and I paid my fair share. Medicare taxes are 1.45% of payroll for both employer and employee. And that's a recent number. In the old days, it was near zero. That means a person who has earned $1 million in the era since Medicare taxes were 2.9% of payroll, contributed a total of $29,000. Ladies and gentlemen, the costs of Medicare are completely out of sync with the contributions paid. Medicare is just a massive transfer of wealth from the generation collecting the benefits for the younger generation. So, how are consumers feeling? Still depressed. The Consumer Sentiment Index, that's the CSI, dropped to 66.6 in mid-September, the lowest since last August. Sentiment among high-income families fell to a 13-month low, while sentiment among low-income families increased for the second straight month. The expectations component sank to an 18-month low, while the present situation was little changed around recent lows. House buying attitudes remained around 4.5-year highs, though near the bottom of its recent flat trend. This month, 73% of consumers said it's a good time to buy a house, while 26% said it was a bad time to buy. Car buying attitudes skidded to a 21-month low, those saying it's a good time to buy a car falling from 65 to 59%, and those saying it's a bad time to buy rising from 22 to 26%. Consumers' opinion of government remains around highs for the year. However, the percentage saying the government is doing a bad job, 41%, is more than double the percentage of those saying it's doing a good job, 16%. The one-year expected inflation rate to a year low of 2.2%. The ABC News Washington Post Consumer Comfort Index fell 3 points during the week ending September the 18th, the largest weekly loss since mid-April. The decline sends the index back to the middle of its range for the year, only 8 points above its all-time low. The buying climate component dropped 6 points for the week, while the personal finances components was 2 points lower. Economic component was unchanged for the fourth straight week. September's U.S. consumer confidence sagged to 48.5 from 53.2 in August. The consensus was expecting 52. The difference between jobs hard to get, jobs plentiful, gapped up to a six-month high of 42.3 from 41.5 in August. Remember that consumer confidence averages 72.9 in recessions and 100.2 in expansions. The Conference Board's present situation index is at 23.1, back to levels prevailing in April 2009. Home buying plans slipped from 2.1 to 1.9 in September, flirting near all-time lows. 46.1% of consumers see business conditions as bad, while only 8.1% see them as good. Only 31% of CEOs plan to hire in the next 6 months, way down from 39% the last time the poll was taken in June. The Consumer Sentiment Composite 20 series of the FHFA dipped 0.1% in July, resuming the primary trend line, which is down. The Richmond Fed Index is pointing to a renewed contraction in industrial activity, sliding from plus 11 in August to minus 2 in September, the weakest reading since the beginning of this year. Shipments slipped to minus 4 from plus 11, and order volumes collapsed, are you ready for this, from plus 41 in April to plus 36 in May to plus 25 in June to plus 13 in July to plus 10 in August to a big fat zero in September. Oh, and backlogs went from zero to minus 11. It had been plus 16 in May. It is abundantly clear that the labor market conditions deteriorated in September, down to minus 3, a seven-month low from plus 12 in August and plus 15 in July. Wages fell to a five-month low of 8 from 13. Prices paid receded to 1.31 from 2.19 in August, and prices received slid to 1.06, the lowest in 7 months, from 1.45 in both July and August. Revenues in the service sector came in at minus 5 in September from minus 10 in August. Have a look at the employment index. Plus 10 in May, plus 2 in June, minus 6 in July, minus 8 in August, and minus 12 in September. You know, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you find this all horrendously boring, but I need to tell you these things because you are being bombarded with exhortations to go out and buy, that everything is getting better, take your money out of savings because you're not earning any interest and just go out and buy things. The economy has turned around. The recovery is in full swing. It's a bunch of lies, ladies and gentlemen. And if you don't get it, reel this thing back, listen to the archive, and listen to these figures again. They tell the story you need to hear. And that's it. I mean, I can come every week and give you more and more and more statistics, but you have to believe this is a depression, and it is grim in the extreme, and it far surpasses in its essence anything that was seen in 1929 or 1930 or thereafter. And then we come to this, you know, quantitative easing. You know, the nearly $1.7 trillion in new money printed by the central bank to ease the financial crisis, it didn't do much good. And its new plan for quantitative easing won't work much better either. If you believe that the central bank's recent hints that it will begin a second round of quantitative easing, well, I can tell you it doesn't make sense, and it will put any economic soundness at risk. You remember in March 2009, the Fed began its shock and awe quantitative easing, buying up nearly $2 trillion in treasury and agency debt in a year. It didn't work. Official interest rates had already been slashed to zero, yet companies weren't borrowing. Even as the first round of quantitative easing ended in March of this year, and nearly a year after the recession ended in June of 2009, the economy sputtered. Today, despite TARP, the stimulus package and the Fed's best efforts, the economy is still sputtering. Just last week, the Fed stated that inflation was below the level most consistent over the long run, quote, with its mandate to promote maximum employment and price stability. And those remarks made clear the central bank fears deflation and a double dip recession. So throwing caution to the wind is gearing up to buy another $1 trillion or so of treasury and agency debt. But this isn't stimulus. You can't print $2.7 trillion in new money and not have it distort markets. This is the kind of thing that got us into trouble in the first place. We shouldn't do it again. Plenty of money is available to fuel economic growth. Businesses themselves have a record $1.8 trillion in cash and equivalents on hand, and banks have nearly $1 trillion in reserves that can be used to back up loans. As I've mentioned so often on the show here, businesses have stopped investing, expanding, and hiring, not because they can't get the loans, but because they're tired of being targeted and demonized by the government. They dread the fiscal and regulatory assaults that await them in coming years, including a badly designed financial reform law, President Obama's healthcare takeover, a looming entitlement crisis, and the possible expiry of the Bush-era tax cuts. Okay, well, let's go to something a little different here. One of our most faithful and observant and regular listeners, Peter Marciano, wrote a little ditty. And I was so impressed when I read it that I thought I would read it to you, ladies and gentlemen. It was written on September the 25th, 2010. Again, Peter Marciano had this to say, and I thought that as a New York resident, it would interest many of the listeners here present, and even those that aren't New York residents will gain a thing or two. So anyway, this is Peter Marciano, 25th of September, and here goes. As I sit overlooking the Manhattan skyline from the New Jersey side, it's a perfect fall day, almost hard to imagine that anything may be wrong with the economy, let alone the country. Behind me, the mall parking lot is absolutely full of shiny, late-model cars. Further around me is the McMansion explosion that suburbia has devolved into. Across the river, Gotham stretches upwards, massive cranes tower over the steel skeletons of new buildings. Planes are in the air, cars race down the West Side Highway, people fill Riverside Park, trucks crab the George Washington Bridge on a beeline to Manhattan and beyond. Small and large pleasure boats move up and down the Hudson River, their tacky fiberglass hulls gleaming in the sun. Two massive oil barges are tethered to tugboats as they unload their cargo of cheap fuel so that America can continue this charade for just a little longer. To an outside observer, even to an average American, everything looks perfect. Everything is in its place and the American economy is booming. The recovery has arrived with a bang. The entire sprawling scene is a picture-perfect snapshot with the words, "You could be living here too," scrawled across the bottom, torn right out of lifestyle sales brochures from a condominium offering plan. Take a minute to look closer. The scene that I am looking upon is a cartoon. Immediately south is the waterfront's fast traveling bridge, a beautiful but decrepit relic from the days of a functioning Manhattan waterfront when barges unloaded rail cars right onto the city streets. Now it's a piece of art, a national historic landmark, according to the brass placard. This bridge is part of the converted industrial waterfront, now a West Side Park that stretches north from Manhattan's Battery Park. In a few years, this bridge, along with the giant steel hulk of a neighboring warehouse, will be history as they rust into the Hudson. Further down the river, past the cruise ship pliers and the ridiculous USS Intrepid floating museum of war, is the newly opened High Line Park. Wait a minute, newly opened? The High Line is another relic of the industrial base of New York, a massive elevated railway on the west side that operated from 1934 and stretched for miles along 10th Avenue and into the factories and manufacturing plants of Manhattan. Now what remains of that line has been converted to a park, much like the multitude of train lines in suburbia whose tracks have been demolished to make way for rail trail bicycle paths. Does anyone ask what happened to the industry that these railways once served? Where are the manufacturing jobs? What will happen when we realize we need the infrastructure back that built the economy? The destruction of our industries is nothing new, and the rails were all but destroyed by the 1970s and replaced with parks in the 2000s. A fair trade, right? The destruction of the industrial base is not a 21st century invention. The relics that remain from the post-manufacturing apocalypse could have served as a warning sign for the great American job outsourcing that was to follow. These jobs, like the railroads, are not coming back. No one has noticed. Uptown excavators at 125th Street are working on Columbia University's new campus extension. This new gulag of a campus will be built on some of the last vestiges of Manhattan's dying economy. The repair shops, welding fabricators, shipping and storage companies, garages, diners, and the last of the uptown meat markets. The land that the campus will be built on was seized by eminent domain, a gift from the U.S. government and the private university's business and law school alumni that have graduated to positions of clout in the corporate world. It's not comforting to realize that with the loss of our rail system, the use of the eminent domain laws for private corporations and developers expedites the decline of this country. No one has noticed. In a few months, the demolition in preparation for Columbia University's new campus will be done. The slaughter complete on some of Manhattan's most solid and spectacular brick industrial buildings. Pieces of their 3-foot-thick brick walls try to hang on, but are no match for the wrecking ball. How many men and women will the new campus employ, and how many of these new employees will be selected from the people displaced by their project? No one will notice. What happens when the graduates of these universities head into the murky labor pool only to find that there is no work? Industries that once thrived on bricks and mortar were sacrificed to build their dorm room or lunch hall, or worse, they were sacrificed for the philosophy that corporate culture disguised as higher learning actually has value and can create wealth. All over the country, the story has been the same. Tear down the old mills and factories, put up a mall. Plant houses in the fields that were once used to feed us. Stress your children into fits with the impossible routines at a young age to increase their chances of getting into a good secondary school, and then it's on to Harvard. Push the Starbucks caffeine and the Macy's charge cards as Americans are convinced to shop. This has become our culture, and shopping seems to be all that we have left. Now we make old factories into condominiums, if they are lucky to survive at all. We argue square feet with our next-door neighbor and boast of how my condo is better than your condo. Our housing stock has been completely hollowed out, where massive pigs of McMansions take front and center stage over what came before, all fueled by cheap money and cheap oil. Where does the wealth get created in this scenario? No one has noticed. I want the trains and rail lines back. I want the artists and engineers back. I want the factories and farms back. I want to demolish the cruise ship, Disney World, plastic house, SUV, jacuzzi empire that we have built that only fuels our debt slavery and leads us to believe that credit is wealth. Perhaps want too much. Peter Marciano, New York City. Very, very impressive and very profound. Peter, thank you very much for that. I am very grateful and very proud to that you have written that for us. And ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've all enjoyed it. All right, ladies and gentlemen, time for our break. We will have it. I will take a little bit of something to drink, and then I'll be right back, and we shall continue.
Progressive Radio Network, celebrating 5 years of independent news.
Hi, Progressives. This is Betsy Rosenberg on the Green Front. I hope you've been enjoying the news I'm bringing you hot off the press, so to speak, like behind-the-scenes stories and insider scoop from Al Gore's recent climate conference. I know the Greenistas and love introducing the most informative and inspiring experts on the Green Front every week. So join me as we learn more about our environment and what we can do to turn it around.
The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, every Wednesday at 2 on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Carol Brier, host of Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m. Please join us as we connect people, ideas, important information, and discover solutions to some of the most urgent problems facing us. Every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m., Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, you're listening to Bhavani. And I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. I haven't talked much about the rampant fraud currently infecting the mortgage foreclosure process. Alan Grayson of Florida opened both barrels on what he called foreclosure fraud factories, and he gives us some examples of people who have got caught in the jaws of the mortgage doomsday machine. He's a very impressive speaker. I always like to hear what he has to say. I hope that he will, at one point, take over some of the functions of those who were so active in the 1930s in uncovering fraud, mostly under the Socorro Commission that I've spoken to you about before, which was largely responsible for the new and improved financial regulations that came about as a result of that. Anyway, Congressman Grayson presents case examples that we're going to listen to in a moment that are actually far from the borrower stereotypes that the bank defenders like to talk about. You will hear that he takes aim at document forgeries. I mean, in the most incredible situation that frankly I've heard about in terms of rampant criminal activity that is going on in front of us, with nobody seems to be talking about it, and certainly nobody's writing about it. He names in particular LPS, which is Lender Processing Services, as a prime actor in this grim spectacle. So anyway, without further ado, let's listen in.
I'm Congressman Alan Grayson, and I represent Central Florida, an area hard hit by the foreclosure fraud crisis. Foreclosure fraud can affect anyone, whether you have a mortgage, are paying on time, have income, or not. The average foreclosure hearing in a Florida court is only 90 seconds. Mistakes are common, and fraud is rampant. Everyone is familiar with dealing with a big bureaucratic institution. What is happening is that these big bureaucratic loan servicers are charging fees inappropriately, refusing to talk to homeowners by putting their calls through to call centers in India, and then foreclosing with forged documents once the homeowner has been drained of all assets and even the will to fight. There's one set of rules for the banks and another set of laws for everyone else. A servicer can ask for fees, it can demand payment, it can send you to one of those call centers in India, and it doesn't have to negotiate. And you now have virtually no rights as a homeowner. Here are four bizarre examples. First, last summer, Fort Lauderdale resident Jason Gradensky experienced what has tragically become an increasingly familiar process all across America. His house was sold at a foreclosure sale after a bank notified the Florida courts that Gradensky had defaulted on his mortgage. The foreclosure came as a surprise to Gradensky, according to reports from the Sun Sentinel. Not only did Gradensky not have a mortgage with the bank that sued to foreclose against his house, he never had a mortgage at all. Gradensky had paid cash for his home. Second, one house in Pinellas County, Florida, saw two mortgage foreclosure suits brought against it because the banks didn't know who had title to the mortgage. Third, one victim with a perfect payment record of all interest and principal was foreclosed on because of a $75 contested late fee. And fourth, Tim and Nicole West were victims of a predatory loan. In 2005, a bank threatened to sue the couple if they didn't sign a refinancing offer. Their loan servicer has subsequently raised their payments from $1,900 a month to $5,300 a month, with regular forbearance fees required in the tens of thousands of dollars. Finally, the servicer refused to accept payments from the family in the name of negotiating for a mortgage modification. But instead of modifying the loan, their servicer began foreclosure proceedings. The servicer used fraudulent documents to prove that it had the right to foreclose. Here's how it all happened. Securitizing mortgages was originally a way to take the cost of the mortgage off of a bank's books. From 2005 onward, the securitization chain went out of control, and Wall Street wanted as many mortgages as it could get as quickly as possible and as cheaply as possible. In order to allow it to pull out more fees at every link in the chain, these subprime lenders, trusts, and banks decided to cut as many costs as possible, including the cost of record keeping. They didn't keep good records, and they violated the laws mandating that they had to file records with the county clerk on who owned what mortgage title. Instead, the bank simply digitized mortgage titles into a privatized system called the Mortgage Electronic Registry System, or MERS. And it did the transfers by trading Excel spreadsheets among the banks and trusts, rather than endorsing the notes as required by their own contracts, by state real estate law, and by IRS rules. Today, MERS is the registered owner of a security interest in 60 million properties, or about 60% of the mortgages in the United States. In fact, 97% of the loans originated between 2005 and 2008 are in the MERS system. It appears that on a widespread and probably pervasive basis, they did not take the steps necessary to own the note, a borrower IOU, which means that in 45 out of the 50 states, they lack the legal right to foreclose. Thus, every trust now has questionable legal standing in foreclosures in the overwhelming majority of states. In addition, their records were poorly kept, so servicers are basically guessing that they have the right to foreclose when they do foreclose. Obviously, the banks do not want to grapple with the consequences of trillions of dollars of securitized mortgages having no legal standing to foreclose. So they have simply created a system where servicers hire foreclosure mill law firms, whose business is to forge documents showing or purporting to show that they have a legal right to foreclose. Some of these foreclosure mills have been featured in the New York Times, and so-called robo-signers, people whose names appear on thousands of affidavits. These appear despite obvious forgeries and overt omissions, and in cases where these people admit that they had no knowledge of what they were signing. The system is so organized that there is a company called Lender Processing Services, which allegedly has created the means to systematize this fraud. Lawyers use the LPS system to request which affidavits and documents they need. LPS then has document mills, where they can magically make an authorized vice president of whoever you need and send you backdated signed documents saying that you have the right to foreclose. Courts at first refused to believe this level of rampant fraud even exists, but more recently, they've started to sanction fraud against loan servicers. Here are some examples of signature forgeries used on documents filed with the courts. These are four clearly forged signatures of document mill employee Linda Green. Here are six signatures of Christina Huang. And here are three obvious forgeries of Taiwana Thomas. Finally, this is a mortgage assignment filed with the recorder's office in which the foreclosing firm forgot to put the name of the assignee. So they instead put bogus assignee. The filing firm simply forgot to change the template for whose home, which family's home, they wanted to take. This is a factory of fraud. Servicers don't make money through routine servicing. It's a break-even business. They make their money on foreclosures at $6,000 for each foreclosure through their fee. When you combine the incentive to foreclose with systemized fraud, it's rampant lawlessness. Fraud is now a big business, and sanctioned in part through the government, as both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are shareholders in MERS. We are approaching the point where the easiest way to make a buck is to steal it. The only way to end this plague of foreclosure fraud is to make sure that crime does not pay. I'm Congressman Alan Grayson. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it speaks for itself. I'm not going to add anything to that. I'm sure you're going to be reading more and more about this. It's going to throw the whole mortgage foreclosure industry into complete and utter turmoil as people look for trust and deed documents which don't exist or have been mislaid or in the hands of previous mortgage companies. It's going to be an absolute debacle of the first order, and look for that to be reflected in the coming weeks and months in the traded markets. That's about all I can usefully comment on at this point. Jerry sent me this brief comment from Zero Hedge, which I thought you might be interested in. For all those who continue to doubt the statistically questionable methods of our Labor Department, as for all others who mock those who doubt the veracity of anything coming out of the BLS, the following charts provide much-needed closure. The top section of the chart demonstrates weekly prior revisions in initial claims for all of 2010, and you may be surprised to discover that beginning in April of 2010, continuing through today, there have been 22 out of 23 consecutive upward prior revisions. In other words, the BLS has a definitive mandate to underrepresent the current weekly data and to allow it to catch up with reality once it has become prior and thus no longer market moving. When in reality, should the BLS present true data, it would have likely missed estimates on more than half the occasions it has, quote-unquote, beaten and caused ridiculous market spikes like the one experienced earlier. Furthermore, combining all individual weekly data demonstrates that the BLS has underrepresented initial claims by roughly 80,000 year-to-date. The chart pretty much leaves no room for doubt as to the BLS, quote-unquote, trans-statistical approach to quantifying data. As for the lower chart, it shows the same thing, but with continuing claims, which have been revised upward pretty much consecutively for the entire year. And that's exactly what they do, ladies and gentlemen. They give you the figures, and then they revise them so that the new figures look much better in relation to the old figures than they really are. Kind of what they do with corporate earnings. They come out with the expectations, and then they lower the expectations as time goes by, so that when the actual figure comes out, it seems like it's much better than the expectations, but in all probability, the reality is lower than the original expectations. It's all done in a giant connivance to get you to buy their wretched stocks, but hopefully it's not working with the people who listen to the wake-up call. Okay, a couple of emails, questions here. We get an email from Mick Russell who says, Richard, when you were a wee lad and the pound sterling was no longer the world's reserve currency, what was it like in Great Britain? Was inflation going up? Did people's morale sink? Were people jumping off buildings? According to a particular article, this seems to be the dollar's fate. What will replace it? How will we react? Mick Russell. Well, that's a very interesting question. It's a good question that you asked me, Mick, because I really was around when the pound sterling started to collapse all at the time of the massive wave of independence that was going around the world with the ex-colonies in the mid-60s. Really, it's a situation which is somewhat different from the American situation in that the old empire was really not a concern of the British working classes. It was a concern of about 5% of the British population, the upper class, for whom the empire was nothing more than a giant playground. And so when they lost their toys, they were the only ones basically that suffered. So the rest of the country really didn't notice anything that was going on. They noticed the inflation. There was inflation, as there was worldwide in the late 60s and 70s, as all Americans who were sentient at that time are aware. It was worldwide. It certainly happened in Britain. But we changed our money in Britain in the beginning of the 70s, too. We had pounds, shillings, and pence, which then became pounds and pence. So, in a sense, it was kind of disguised in the eyes of the British. They didn't really notice as much as they would have in other countries what was going on. Certainly, it was a shock. It was a difficult time for businesses that had to reassess their loans. They had to reassess the payment structures that they had when the dollar took over as the world's reserve currency. It was a very rocky period, and it was we were in a full-scale recession during that time, as I'm sure you all remember. Pretty much the same thing. The precious metals commodities were rising. It was an inflationary period, which this is not. So there was a big difference in that respect as well. People were able to produce. They got better jobs. They got paid more money for their jobs. There was more money printing, but there was, of course, more use for that money. So the actual inflationary element was very real, and it did get broken in the United States when Volcker came and pushed interest rates up to stem the horrendous inflation that you all will remember if you were around at that time. The prime rate was up, I think, at 21% at one point. We had the same thing that happened in England. The dollar's fate is already being seen as we speak. The dollar is collapsing, really collapsing. It's down again today in a very major way. The euro is up at 140. Everybody thought it was going to parity with the dollar when it was down at about 118 with the problems in Europe. But if America will keep printing money, with gay abandon, and Bernanke refuses to kowtow to the laws of economics 101, then clearly there will be consequences to be paid. And unfortunately, the American people will be those who pay them. So it's not going to be fun. How will we react, Mick? I think there will be social unrest. Eventually, I think when people realize that their savings have been depleted, that there is no interest on those savings, that it's going to get harder and harder to make ends meet. Taxes will probably rise to meet the growing needs of and the shortfalls of the municipalities and indeed the federal government. There's really no knowing how irresponsible these people can get. Their past track record is not encouraging. But we shall just have to see, all of which, again, I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, we are talking so often here about going to live elsewhere. Indeed, this weekend I'll be sending out a actually very interesting, if rather touristy, article about Sri Lanka, which was lovingly prepared by my wife into files which will be winging their merry way on the email distribution list, which I have. It's what I call the weekend reading. It's the portion of the emails. And anyone who would like to receive a copy should please email me, and I will return it with the files. And if you'd like to join my distribution list, please also include your full name and your phone number. This is not so that I can bombard you with junk mail. It's because I really need this for my records as pertains to the requirements of the SEC and the FINRA, otherwise known as the powers that be. And in case you didn't know, there are now 50,000 Americans who have relocated to Costa Rica, and 100,000 Americans are moving to Mexico every year. So there you go. A comment from Steve, our trusted scribe, Steve Kruger, who says, Richard, I think it was 2005 when the Fed decided not to go public with M3 numbers, saying they were no longer relevant. That's the general money supply figures, ladies and gentlemen. You have to know that they knew exactly what was in store for us at that point. With the Fed praying for inflation and M3 going lower every quarter, indicating a shrinking money supply, not an expanding one, they solved the problem by not printing M3. Man, what a great job the Fed has done. It's a damn shame that someone didn't tell the Christians to just ignore the lions and they would be safe. When the lying SOBs running this 100-year Ponzi scam bury their heads in the sand as they're doing, you can bet that the Fed is going to collapse. And the sooner the better. Steve Kruger. Thank you, Steve. The financial media reports that, quote, applications for U.S. unemployment benefits decreased last week, a sign that companies are cutting back on firings even as economic growth slows, end of quote. Really? Initial jobless claims are also reported to have decreased by 16,000 to 453,000. However, as I mentioned just now, previous week's claims number was revised higher from 465 to 468,000. And what is worse is that the prior week's continuing claims were also revised higher from 4.48 million to 4.54 million. What's the point in believing any of these numbers if they're just revised higher week after week? And even worse, long-term benefit recipients declined by 256,000 because they exceeded 99 weeks of maximum claims. Is this supposed to be good? That this is reported as good news, which it was, is frankly stunning to me. Well, the basic outlines of the current situation really are fairly simple. The economy was operating at near full employment levels of output in 2007 before the collapse of the housing bubble threw the economy into the most severe recession since the Great Depression. And when the bubble burst, construction plummeted as builders realized that there would be no demand for the houses they were building. There was also a bubble in non-residential real estate leading to a bubble building boom in retail and office space as well as hotels. Non-residential construction also collapsed in response to this overbuilding. Well, the combined fall-off in annual residential and non-residential construction spending has been close to $600 billion. The collapse of the housing bubble also sent consumption plummeting. The bubble had generated more than $8 trillion of additional housing equity. Homeowners spent against that equity created by the housing bubble, just as they would against their other housing equity, since they didn't know the equity came from a bubble. Economists usually estimate the size of the housing wealth effect as 5 to 7%, meaning that the $8 trillion in bubble-generated equity would have led to $400 billion to $560 billion a year in annual consumption. Well, thus far, the bubble is close to two-thirds deflated, meaning that the value of housing has fallen by close to $6 trillion. This does not mean that $6 trillion of consumer debts based on the original bubble have been erased. That is the big mistake economists make when they say that all that is needed for the government to increase spending to help consumers out of the hole. Well, ladies and gentlemen, just consider this. Let me go and take some of these figures. I mentioned that when the bubble took place, it generated $8 trillion of additional housing equity. Now, what this meant was that consumers went out. Did they spend $8 trillion? No, of course they didn't. They took loans from that $8 trillion of additional equity. Loans with banks that were happy to provide them with the money they wanted. And that is what they spent. They didn't spend $8 trillion. That $8 trillion I mentioned was simply a rise in the value of the houses. That was not money. However, what the public spent was $8 trillion of money, which the banks lent them, because they thought that the value of real estate would continue. Now, when the value of real estate fell by $8 trillion, of course it wasn't $8 trillion of money that fell. It was $8 trillion of phantom wealth which fell. But the value of the money that the consumer had spent was still $8 trillion real dollars. And that $8 trillion had to be paid back. And that is what deleveraging is all about. That is what we are witnessing today. The payback of a sum of money which never really existed in terms of consumer wealth in the first place. It was, in fact, loans against fantasy. And the reality is that the banks should have known better than to lend that $8 trillion out. But what happened was, ladies and gentlemen, as I'm sure you all know, that when push came to shove and the banks found themselves in trouble, the federal government came in and gave the banks the equivalent of the $8 trillion to get them out of the hole. They didn't give that money to the consumer, they gave it to the banks. Remember, the banks lent it to the consumer, so the consumer is $8 trillion in the hole, but the government didn't give the consumer the $8 trillion, they gave the money to the banks. Remember, they didn't give the money in order for the consumer to write his own balance sheet. They gave it to the banks to write theirs. And that was what TARP was all about, and that was what the great heist of 2008 was all about. Giving the wrong people the money. They probably shouldn't give the money to anybody. But the fact that they gave that money to the banks, because the banks had loaned that money out injudiciously, is in fact, of course, a gigantic scandal that really nobody seems able to talk about. Basically, the theft was from the taxpayer, because of course the money had to come from somewhere. The $8 trillion equivalent didn't just come from the sky. It was printed up against a bill payable by the taxpayers that in fact has now become debt to the taxpayers and credit to the banks of $8 trillion. Plus, I mean, I'm simplifying the issue, of course, but I hope you understand the gross immorality of what they did, of what Henry Paulson decided he thought he could get away with, and what Congress saw as being a heist, which meant that they'd refused it the first time it was presented to them to sign off on. They actually refused it. And Paulson just changed a few words around and put a few extra commas in here and took a few away there, presented them again literally a few days later, and Congress just arrogantly signed off on it. So you see, ladies and gentlemen, when the resentment really bubbles up, when you really see, when people could take a retrospective view to all this and they see what was done, they will react. I assure you, the people of the United States will rise up and react against this. And the only reason that they're not doing so right now is because they simply don't understand what happened. It is extremely difficult to explain. And very few people are able to explain it, and very few of those have the credibility among the general public to be believed. Well, I'd like to think I'm one of them, but the problem is I don't really reach much of the general public. I do reach my faithful listeners at the wake-up call, but Unfortunately, we don't get very far with just a few hundred or hopefully 1,000 people that are listening to our shows. But very soon now, this will start to permeate through. And the fascinating presentation by Alan Grayson will go a long way to showing people exactly what's going on. And this is just the tip of the iceberg, ladies and gentlemen. This is not something which can be seen to be an end in and of itself. This is a typical situation, the situation I mentioned with the foreclosures notices with Grayson, and indeed this whole element of what happened with money and how the taxpayers just been ripped off right, left, and center. This kind of thing with, and I've got plenty of other stories, by the way, for you as well, which we shall deal with in the fullness of time. This kind of thing will just compound itself in the minds of people, and then there will be trouble. There will be all hell to pay. I am convinced of it. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, it's been a pleasure, as always, talking to you, and I will be back on Monday. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. This is Richard Martin wishing you the best of times. See you soon. Take care. Bye-bye.